You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. It is my distinct privilege and pleasure to welcome Yuri Luik, the Minister of Defense for the Republic of Estonia, to Brookings today for a conversation about his country's military preparations and more generally NATO's preparations for defending its eastern flank. I'm just going to give a couple words of additional introduction, then we'll hear from the minister. He and I will then converse a little bit on stage, and we'll look forward to your thoughts in the Q&A part of the final 20 minutes or so of the hour. So we have really seen a man of a remarkable career now re-engage and retake the position of Minister of Defense, a position he had held in the early years when Estonia had regained its independence. As you know, and if you drive around Washington, watch up and down Mass Ave, you would have seen a year ago or so that the three Baltic states were celebrating 100 years of independence, but of course it was an independence that was then taken from them, and they suffered enormously in the period of World War II, and then during the Soviet annexation, if you will, a process that was never recognized by the United States government and which mercifully came to an end with the end of the Cold War. So Estonia has now been back as an independent state for some three decades, and it has been a member of NATO since 2004 in the big round of expansion that had been announced in 2002. I should also note, by way of introduction, that the minister has had a number of positions in his government which give him a broad view of the problem, not strictly in military terms, including being minister and ambassador extraordinaire to Moscow, get this, from 2012 to 2015. So he was there in a pretty interesting and important time. One last point by way of general introduction about Estonia. As you know, NATO has its cyber command and does a great deal of cyber activity and exercising in Estonia. So it has been important in that regard as well. It's a country that meets its 2% obligations, spending as a fraction of GDP. So its military budget in percentage terms is among NATO's highest. This still, of course, only permits a small military within a country of 1.3 million people, but a very impressive military nonetheless. And so without further ado, Mr. Minister, thank you for being here, and the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Mike, and extremely happy to be here. I mean, in such a distinguished institution with such distinguished participants, very happy to see Stroop here, my old friend. I've been also Estonian ambassador to Washington from 2003 to 2007, and was a frequent visitor here in this August settings, always had very interesting debates. Let me start with some words of introduction, and then I'd be very happy to continue in the discussion format. Let me offer you a view from NATO's eastern flank about the security situation in the Baltic Sea region and what we, Estonia, the United States, and allies are doing together in order to strengthen our common security and defense. Allow me, however, to first say a few words about the significance and the role that is played by the NATO alliance in general. We have a working alliance, but we need to strengthen it further, including through even stronger commitment by every member. That is why we all pledged to spend more on defense, and to do it wisely. Estonia achieved the NATO-agreed defense spending target of 2% of GDP, and we are now even exceeding it years ago. And a growing number of allies have done it as well. The burden sharing in NATO is increasingly fair. Since the Russian annexation of Crimea and NATO summits in Wales in 2014, North Atlantic Alliance has returned to its core task, collective defense. And it has done so for a very good reason. Russia did not only launch a massive armaments and defense reforms program since 2009, But it also unilaterally took the course of outright and aggressive confrontation with the West, particularly against the United States. Its attacks and invades its neighbors, it deploys forces and wages indiscriminate war in Syria, defending a criminal regime, and it interferes also militarily, including using private military companies in Venezuela, in Libya, and other countries. The security situation in Europe has deteriorated since 2014 due to Russia's efforts to strengthen its regional posture. Russia deploys to its western military district a wide range of modern offensive weapons and capabilities, including SSC-8 land-based missile systems that stood in violation with the INF Treaty. These dual-capable weapons systems are suitable for surprise precision strikes, threaten the entire Europe, and could, in conflict situations, become a game-changer. NATO's actions and measures adjusting its deterrence and defense posture have been taken in a step-by-step order that is transparent, non-provocative, and based on sufficiency. Russia, on the other hand, would hardly exclude the use of force when circumstances seem promising for exploiting our vulnerabilities. The US-led exercise Defender Europe 2020, the biggest allied exercise since the end of Cold War, will surely send a powerful and convincing strategic message to Moscow. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov recently stated that Russia would respond to Defender with its own borders, which is, of course, very reassuring to all of us. But he also added that Russia keeps its nukes at home differently from the US. That statement is, of course, to remind us that Russia has a huge nuclear arsenal. As the frontline state, we in Estonia work daily to ensure credible defense and deterrence on the border with Russia. We will continue to maintain defense bonding, but in order to improve our readiness, we conduct regular, no-notice defense readiness exercises for our reserve army. For instance, in 2019, we held SNAPEX for two reserve battalions at the same time. Less than 40 hours after the government's decision to launch the exercise, one infantry battalion had moved more than 60 miles from the formation location and was ready for battle. You know, if you have a reserve army, you have to make sure that A, it works, B, it works in time. So Estonia is doing these SNAPEX exercises starting from a B team giving a signal to the Estonian government that now there is a crisis. And we work very quickly, and as I pointed out, in 40 hours, the battalion is already in place out of its mobilization area. This is equal to how the professionals work. So for a small country whose defense is based on reserves, this is something which has to be trained and retrained all the time, and this is really important for us. In addition to Estonia's efforts, NATO has made substantial and visible steps in bolstering collective defense. Besides US leadership, its continuing commitment in NATO and military presence in Europe, especially on the eastern flank, our European allies have considerably bolstered their commitment. The UK-led NATO Enhanced Forward Presence Battle Group, which is supported by France and Denmark in Estonia, is an interoperable and integral part of our defense forces. It serves as an example of long-term, real commitment to transatlantic security and ability to deter and defend the alliance borders. Just as a side remark, people often say Europe is not doing enough. I think we have to qualify this by remembering that there are now countries like Great Britain, like Germany, and many, many other European countries, France, who are standing in the front line in the Baltic states. They are standing as a tripwire, and they are really making perhaps not a large military effort, but an enormous political effort in bringing their boys into the harm's way and providing this important line of deterrence when it comes to supporting the Baltic states. So we are deeply appreciative to countries like the United Kingdom, which is in Estonia, Canada, which is the lead nation in Latvia, Germany. I think we all understand what a difficult decision it must have been for Germans, for the German government, to take an armored battalion and bring it to Lithuania. I think we all imagine how difficult and complicated such a decision must have been, but it was made. So kudos for that. When it comes to resources, continuing U.S. contribution to our defense capability development is visible, and it's very much appreciated. It enhances our national and regional capabilities, but also interoperability with the U.S. and other allies. Baltic region is a single operational area, and all national efforts must and do support wider regional and NATO plans and activities in the region. Our cooperation with Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland is very close and wide-ranging, and we are dedicated to develop our national capabilities while increasing interoperability and working together to use all resources in a way that will bring most value to the region. Estonia, of course, is an active contributor to the global security. We are fully aware of our responsibilities in the fight against terrorism and working shoulder to shoulder with our allies. You know, again, sometimes in the NATO debates, there are southern allies who point out that we are investing too much to the east. We are focusing on the eastern flank. I always point out that all actual NATO operations are basically related to the south or to the southeast. When it comes to Afghanistan, Iraq, Estonia is now in Mali, which is not a NATO operation, but certainly proves a point of us being in the south, quite far from Estonian shores, as you can appreciate. We welcome the conclusions of the Afghanistan-U.S. joint statement for peace and settlement between the U.S. and Taliban. We think these are important first steps in pursuit of a peaceful settlement to the conflict in Afghanistan. Estonia continues its commitment to the Resolute Support Mission and for Operation Inherent Resolve against the threat posed by ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Moreover, we are further increasing our sizable contribution to Operation Barkhane in Mali. We also contribute to the US-led Operation Sentinel, aimed at increasing security in key waterways in the Middle East. Dear friends, Russia's confrontation with the West is an existential necessity for the current regime in Moscow. Dialogue with Kremlin is difficult, actually at the moment it's futile, as long as it is not interested in solving any crisis or conflicts, but rather seeks to exploit existing ones and create new hotspots. Furthermore, Russia's ruling kleptocratic elite is now very busy with clearing the path to post-2024 preservation of power. The biggest problem of Putin's regime is that it is not able to offer to Russia's people a better future. Therefore, it makes desperate efforts to offer them a quote-unquote better past. Russia and the West are at odds with each other over all relevant issues, and the list of disputes includes the interpretation of history, more precisely that of World War II and the preceding years that led to the outbreak of war. For instance, Kremlin accuses Poland for being almost a partner in the crime of Nazi Germany, bearing an equal responsibility for the outbreak of the World War II. Moscow's cynicism and willingness to turn history into a theater of absurd seems to have no limits. Russia also claims that the Estonian-Russian Tartu Peace Treaty, signed by Estonia and Soviet Russia in 1920, that ended Estonian victorious war on independence and actually qualified or codified the independence of Estonia from Russia, is null and void, since Estonia in 1940 voluntarily joined the Soviet Union. The two neighboring countries thus have no mutually accepted basis for the legal continuity of their bilateral relations. The U.S. Secretary of State Pompeo has recently rightly compared Tartu Peace Treaty's importance with that of the U.S. Declaration of Independence. Both the Treaty of Tartu, and I quote, and the U.S. Declaration of Independence speak of a spirit of self-determination, the right of nations, people, to end the rule of foreign power over their territory and achieve their own independence. Now, why does Kremlin stick so fiercely to the narrative that Russia liberated and did not conquer Central and Eastern Europe, including the Baltic states? And why it is so keen to forget all horrors of the Stalinist regime? The answer comprises both domestic and international aspects, including patriotic national identity building. A particularly important feature for the Baltic states and NATO in this context is Russia's refusal to give up its centuries-long concept of buffer zones. Moscow perceives buffer zones as the only way to project power and to protect Russia's western and southern rims from the Arctic to the Caspian and East Mediterranean. I stop here and look forward to our conversation. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Mr. Minister, thank you. It's a powerful perspective and a reminder of the severity of the challenges we face and what's been done to address them. If I could, before we get into a couple more questions on defense policy, I wanted to ask you about your best effort to read the Russian mind and their long-term aspirations. Because as I hear your speech, on the one hand, you talk about spheres of influence. And sometimes that's interpreted as just Russia not wanting countries along its borders to be part of NATO. But you also talked about Russia essentially rejecting the 1920 treaty that gave you independence and implying that maybe you shouldn't be independent after all. We know that Vladimir Putin has called the dissolution of the Soviet Union the greatest strategic catastrophe of the 20th century. That sort of implies he wants to put it back together. And we also know that he's claimed a right to defend Russian speakers wherever they may be, and 25% of your population, of course, roughly is Russian speaking. So do you think that Russia's main interest in the Baltics, including in Estonia, is to retake them in some way at some point? Or is it more about harassment, more about destabilization, more about making NATO pay a price for having expanded, more about just making sure everyone knows that he's not happy with the current situation?
I think it's an excellent question. And of course, finally, there are a lot of motivations kind of melded together. So it's you cannot sort of bring out only one of them. For me, a lot of what Putin does has has its main roots in the internal policy of Russia. And I seriously believe that things might become even more complicated. As you have seen, President Putin has developed a very sophisticated but complicated system of leaving the presidency but staying in power. And of course, to be absolutely sure that this system works is very difficult. I mean, there are so many variables here. So the desire to mobilize the nation, to give space, political space, to transformation of power is something which is, I believe, a real risk. So when I saw that Putin has suddenly thrown out a list of changes to the Constitution, I became quite worried. Now let's see where it develops. There are different proposals for the constitutional changes. Some of them are purely for power preservation. Some of them are to change the nature of the Russian regime, even more inward-looking and even more to have a kind of a closed society. But I'm pretty sure that this transformation time could lead to further foreign adventures, military or otherwise. I actually interpret the present, I call it Putin's war on history. I interpret the present war, of course, it's a great moment to utilize it because of the end of the 75th anniversary of the Great Patriotic War. It is, again, part of the internal political consolidation. But the fact is also that the Russian leadership, as it stands today, has not accepted, fundamentally has not accepted, the results of the fall apart of the Soviet Union. I mean, exactly in what way would they want to remedy it very much depends on the situation. I mean, these are opportunist people, so they are looking for circumstances which might lead to new opportunities. An opportunity was grabbed with Ukraine, unfortunately. In a very difficult moment for Ukraine, Russia attacked, and it's a very sad example to all of us. So that's why I'm always saying that our biggest, our strongest trump card is firmness, clarity of our intentions, peaceful intentions, and the fact that NATO is in the Baltic states is kind of embodiment of that firmness, that clarity. NATO's border is not a line in the sand. I don't think Putin believes in lines in the sand. It's a real border. It's a real protected territory. And the NATO units in Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania make it abundantly clear.
All right, that's a great answer. Our colleague, Angela Stent, who's also a professor at Georgetown, you probably know her work, she says that Putin is often described as a great chess player, but he's actually better understood as a judo practitioner, not only in his sports, but in his geopolitics, because he looks for the opportunity, looks for the mistake, looks for the action of the adversary, and then reacts and tries to exploit. Sounds like you agree.
I think that's exactly to the point.
So let me now move over towards defense policy, and it follows naturally from this question of Russian motives. And it really is going to be a question about how much is enough, or have we done enough to essentially protect NATO's eastern flank, and specifically the Baltics. You mentioned that we now have battalions, multinational battalions, in each of the three Baltic states, led by the United Kingdom in your country, and then Canada, and then Germany, and then finally the United States, with its presence of about 5,000 U.S. personnel in Poland. So it's about 5,000 Americans in Poland, about 5,000 more NATO in the Baltic states, in what's sort of a, impressive combat capability, but also an amalgamation of companies and not even full battalions for the most part. And then, of course, the Baltic states are impressive, and I appreciated your statistics on what your armed forces are capable of doing on short notice, but they're small. And 2% of GDP is impressive relative to the NATO standard, but it may not be seen as all that high relative to historical standards like the Cold War. So basically, have we done enough? Do you think that being clear in our intentions with this tripwire force, as you described it, is adequate? And Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania all reaching that 2% goal? Or do you think we need to think harder about the ability to really defend in a frontline way the Baltic states and then reinforce those positions quickly, even more than NATO has done so far? So how much of this is a sort of a signaling issue, and we've therefore largely achieved our goals, and how much of it is a real defense planning question where we've got to have more capability and the ability to bring a lot more fast?
As a defense minister, I have a whole list of things in my pocket which I would like to get as soon as possible. When people speak about battalions, I would say better to have a brigade. People speak about brigades, I am shooting for a division. So it's clear that to have credible deterrence, we have to do more. Because I don't believe that Russians would take a purely symbolic deterrence seriously. We have the tripwire, but we don't have a clear answer to the question, what will happen if somebody trips on the tripwire? I mean, what are the next steps? I'm not saying that we don't have answers. What I'm saying is that NATO is lacking operationally capable mobile forces which could be quickly deployed in necessary, as General Mattis, Secretary Mattis called them, speed of relevance. So training the reinforcements, something which became a forgotten culture after the Cold War, we have to remind ourselves how it was done. And that's why I mentioned the U.S. exercise Defender 2020. This is basically very similar to the Cold War Reforger exercise. The United States is bringing in April and May 25,000 men and women from the continental United States to Europe. Now, this is a big number. It's not a big number in Cold War terms, but in present terms, it's a big number. And, of course, this exercise will be interlocking with exercises in different NATO countries, which sort of add their own manpower to the exercise. For instance, Estonia is doing its own biggest military exercise, spring storm, so to say, together with the American exercise. So all in all, we are talking about roughly 40,000 men and women exercising in Europe. This is a considerable force, and I think it underlines the fact that it is not only the tripwire, but it is also our ability to quickly reinforce, which builds a credible deterrent. Because the political deterrent carries you only so far. But the opponent has to know that you have developed all the nooks and crannies of this challenge, and you actually have the capabilities to reinforce your red line.
So one more question along those lines, and then pretty soon I'll go to the audience. General Richard Sheriff, who, as you know, is Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe, he retired from that position a few years ago and wrote a book, and we hosted him here for a book talk, and you probably read it. It's called War with Russia, and it's a novel, but it's meant to assume a scenario that he took very seriously, that you take very seriously, a Russian attack on the Baltics. And he paints a very dire picture. Of course, this was also several years ago when NATO hadn't made as much progress on burden sharing. But he also raised some doubts about whether the enhanced forward presence should continue to be these small pieces of individual national contribution, again, a company here, a company there, or whether it should be a more integrated traditional combat brigade, or maybe even two brigades, that would in addition to the reinforcement capability you're talking about, provide a tougher, more credible forward defense in place. Is that kind of a debate needed? Do we also need a debate about whether the Baltics should maybe even envision 3 or 4% of their GDP going to their militaries? Or do you feel like if we get the reinforcement capability more clearly demonstrated through exercises and other preparations that that should be adequate?
I think from the military point of view, General Sheriff is of course right. I wrote a study. I was then at an Estonian think tank called ICDS, and I wrote a study with him which was called Closing the Baltic Gap, and I saw some of those ideas also in his book. It is clear that from the purely military perspective, it would be wise to have combat brigades in place, also because Russia has the ability to close the so-called A2AD bubble and make it more difficult to bring in reinforcements. But I think we have to look at it also from the point of view of real politics. I mean, the likelihood that countries would come up with brigades and station them to the Baltic states at the moment, in the present circumstances, is quite small still. So I think we are at the moment making the best of what we have. In Estonia, you have British battalion with one additional company. It's either French or Danes. So this makes it actually a battle-ready formation. Now, in other Baltic states, you have, I think in Latvia, there are 10 to 12 nations. Right. This is clearly more complicated and probably has a more political ring to it. But the fact, again, that so many nations participate, that there is an Italian flag, Spanish flag, all nations literally present, is, of course, a very strong symbolic point.
Right. Very good. Thank you. I'm going to now open it up. Please wait for a microphone, and once you get it, please identify yourself before asking your question. We'll start with the gentleman near the back.
Thank you very much. My name is David Nikuradze. I represent Georgian television station Formula in Washington, D.C. Recently, Georgia hit by a massive cyber attack from Russia. Our international community condemned Russia's action, and Secretary Pompeo said that additional technical assistance will be offered for Georgia. I wonder if alliance is going to strengthen cybersecurity in the region and whether candidate states will be included. Thank you very much.
I think the alliance, NATO grappled a long time with this new threat of cyber warfare. I think we have now found a good solution whereby countries bring their national capabilities and allow NATO to coordinate, but do not give these assets to any type of joint unit or what have you. In some ways, it has certain similarity to nuclear sharing policy of the alliance. So these are national capabilities. And if partners have national capabilities, which they can provide, I'm sure NATO can use them as well or work them with certain caveats, limits, and framework, but work with them as well. I think that would be only natural. And of course, when it comes to the Georgian case, then I'm very happy that the last cyber attack against Georgia was called out by the international community, including the United States, including Estonia. We have actually reached a moment whereby we can actually identify the perpetrators. The perpetrators of cyber attacks should know that this common understanding that cyber warfare is great because you can never identify the perpetrator, it's not true anymore. There are already forensic possibilities to pinpoint quite clearly who is there to be blamed. And we believe in Estonia that public blaming and shaming is the best way to deter these attacks. Naming the perpetrators, even if it's a cyber attack, which perhaps is not visible in any meaningful way.
Very quick follow-up on that before we come to this gentleman. When you talk about naming and shaming being the best response, I agree, but I also wonder how you would respond to somebody who says, well, Vladimir Putin doesn't care if you name and shame him. He'll just tell a lie and say it wasn't him. But I want to hear your answer. I think the answer is that because within the NATO alliance and the EU, we trust our own intelligence, and it's pretty rock solid. Therefore, the kinds of sanctions that have been imposed on Russia are established and sustained, even when there's a lot of debate within NATO and within the EU about how to treat Putin, how to react. But we have such strong consensus on Russian guilt that we are able to use these kinds of attacks as one of the reasons we then keep these sanctions so strong for so long. Is that how you look at it? I mean, why does name and shame work with someone like Vladimir Putin?
I think Putin often looks for degree of deniability. It's not only cyber attacks. It's easy to say, I didn't do a cyber attack. I mean, the guy is saying, I have no troops in eastern Ukraine, or I haven't deployed INF-forbidden missiles, or et cetera, et cetera. I don't have Wagner in Africa. So he is going to deny whatever you say. But I think naming and shaming and showing who has attacked, it still has a certain preventive nature. It makes it more difficult to blatantly violate the law, blatantly violate the sovereignty of other countries. An important example from Estonia is also that when our airspace is violated by Russian planes, we always make it public. We always call in the Russian ambassador. We always pass on an official protest, so that it's not something they know that every time they do it, they have to go through this process of explaining that it wasn't them or it was just an accident. But anyway, it creates a kind of not a very easy and comfortable situation to the violators.
Thank you. Sir? Yes, it's coming right up.
Mark Anderson, I'm an independent journalist. Kind of a two-part question. On the one hand, you said earlier, Mr. Speaker, that you expected or would prefer that Russia would drop its buffer zones. Is that correct? Did I hear you right? That Russia should get rid of or disband its buffer zones?
Well, it's policy.
Yeah, it's a two-part question. I mean, wouldn't any nation be expected to maintain buffer zones? Because Russia is going to perceive NATO as the expansionist power block. It's almost like everything's in reverse. It depends on which end of the telescope you're looking down. And in addition, Vladimir Putin is a lot of things, rather untrustworthy in a lot of ways, but he's not stupid. What benefit would he get out of attacking the Baltics? I mean, the response, the retaliation would be overwhelming. He's a lot of things, but he's not stupid. So I just don't see Russia being that reckless. I'm just playing the devil's advocate.
You know, wars have been started by very smart men. So it's not necessarily a guarantee that only stupid people start wars. It will be evident usually later that it was extremely stupid to start a war. But often people don't get it beforehand. I mean, it's starting a conflict is often something which is to do with... Let me ask you, why did Russia attack Ukraine? I mean, if I would have been a think tanker before the Ukrainian-Russian war, and I would have been sitting here, and I would have said, you know, at some point I envision Ukraine and Russia having war between themselves, I would have been considered crazy. I mean, I would have been kicked out of the think tank community. Russia and Ukraine, I mean, two brotherly nations, one nation born out of the other nation, part of the common heritage. If some nations can be part of common heritage, then it's Russia and Ukraine. And still we have a war between them. So I'm always very careful when people say to me, Putin will never attack you. Because people who say that, I apologize, but people who say that don't have means to guarantee what they say. They might be right, but they might be wrong. And if they are wrong, they cannot help me. So that's why I prefer kind of clarity and preparedness. I mean, NATO battalions compared to the Russian armies, tank armies, on the other side of the Estonian border. I mean, it's a very small military capability, really small. So it's not something where we could say it's extremely provocative or... I am personally a great believer that weakness is the most provocative way of provoking a conflict rather than strength. I think we saw it in Ukraine. The moment of weakness, which was immediately utilized. So we must be strong.
Before I go to Harlan for the next question, just to follow up on this myself, I wonder, though, when you and I realize this is not your immediate day-to-day concern, but when you think about the long-term future of Ukraine and Georgia, of course, NATO has an open-door policy in effect. Since 2008, NATO has promised that someday we would try to bring Ukraine and Georgia in, but there's no interim security guarantee and there's no timetable. Vice President Pence, I think in 2017, went to Georgia and said, again, the pledge remains, the open door policy remains, but of course it's not something that's been acted upon. Is it realistic to keep that promise or that hope and hope to implement it anytime soon? Or is that maybe a concept that's better rethought? That maybe, not that Russia deserves a sphere of influence, but that putting yourself in Moscow's eyes and coming right into the former Soviet space, into the heartland, into Ukraine and Georgia, would really be a bridge too far, even if it might have been, you know, very smart and wonderful to have allies like the Baltic states join NATO. Ukraine and Georgia, perhaps, are just in a different category altogether. Is that a debate we should have as an alliance?
I don't think so, because all these debates inadvertently sort of support the Russian buffer zone, near broad policy. It's written in the books at the Bucharest summit that Ukraine and Georgia will be members of NATO, full stop. Now, even politically, you couldn't remove it from there. There are reasons to remove it from there. Might be that you cannot act on it today, but... As we have seen with the Baltic states, what is written somewhere might not be useful today, but it might be very useful tomorrow. For instance, the United States government recognized for 50 years Estonian ambassadors and consul generals in Washington. There were a lot of people in Washington who believed this wasn't a smart thing to do and it's totally irrelevant and why should we do stuff like that? After 50 years, suddenly the guy who was our consul general for 50 years, a fairly old distinguished diplomat, Ernst Jackson, became our first ambassador to Washington. So I've always said to Ukrainians and Georgians, this line in the documents is inactive today, but tomorrow people will refer to it if they want to take you in. So it's not worthless. For me, the Bucharest document is an important document, and it's clear that it will not happen now, but I'm pretty sure it will happen at some point.
Thank you. In the future. Thank you, Harlan.
I'm Harlan Ullman. Mr. Minister, thank you very much for your comments. I am just literally back from Romania, where I've been working very closely with the Minister of Defense and the Chief of Defense on their strategic defense review. And two areas where I think that they've done some very interesting analysis. First is a forensic study of the brigade and battalion tactical groups that the Russians have mounted, particularly their strengths and weaknesses, as well as a very interesting analysis of the drone attacks against Saudi oil facilities last summer. And the results from those analyses reveal a number of systems that are not very, very expensive, but could relatively easily disrupt a potential Russian attack. I wonder if Estonia is using that same level analysis to look at other systems that could be hugely disruptive, but are far less expensive than F-35 and M1 tanks.
For a small country, it's unavoidable that you would use the advantages your brains against an overwhelming armored force. And it is indeed true that a lot of things can be done using the meager capabilities you have. A lot of weaknesses, the opposing side always has a lot of weaknesses. I think we shouldn't also mystify the Russian army. I mean, it has its problems. It has a lot of problems. So I think it's right to say that defending the Baltic states is not only a problem of force counting, but it's an almost, I would say, an intellectual problem. So indeed, without going into to details, we are taking that into consideration. And sometimes, if your enemy goes high-tech, it helps you to go low-tech, because you have then a lot of advantages which the high-tech options do not provide, as we have seen in our international operations elsewhere around the world, where an extremely low-tech opponent has been successful, essentially, against a very high-tech international coalition.
It's very memorable. It's almost like a Michelle Obama line. When they go high-tech, we go low-tech. I won't forget that one. Thank you. See if anybody else has some questions. We've got 5 more minutes or so. We've got 2 in the back. Why don't we take them together and then see if we can come back to the minister at that point.
Яна Слесарчук, 1+1 Media Ukraine. My question is about this common problem in Ukraine and in Estonia at some part of population which are tuned into Russian media, Russian propaganda, and Russia is counting on them as the field in where all kinds of provocations can be done. So, how do you see the possibilities to deter this danger, like to work with it? How do you see this problem in Estonia and in Ukraine? Thank you.
And then right behind, please.
Hi, Mr. Minister. Thank you for being here. My name is Olivia Zay, and I am a defense and foreign policy intern at the Cato Institute. So I have a question to you about the Trump administration pulling out of the Intermediate Nuclear Force Treaty. What's your opinion on the implications in the Russia and NATO relationship in the future? Do you think that the United States should deploy more intermediate nuclear force, intermediate nuclear weapons to the NATO allies in the future in order to counter the Russian threats to the region?
Thank you. Thank you for that question. Let me start with the propaganda issue. I must say, and I might be surprising people here, I don't see it in Estonia as a major problem. Estonia is an EU country, relatively wealthy. The Russian community in Estonia is relatively integrated to the fabric of our society. So the likelihood that somebody can simply, with a fake news or with some kind of a info operation, change their views about Estonia are very slim. I don't see a tool of doing that. And you know it better than I do, but in Ukraine it's also not an ethnic conflict. So there are Russian speakers often on both sides of the administrative line. So I'm not too worried about that. And in a surprising way, Russians lately don't spend much money in their immediate neighborhood. I mean, they basically have two tools for propaganda. One is the Channel One, Russia Today. The Russian. What is the Россия? RT. Россия 24. Russia 24. Which are meant mainly for internal consumption. And Russians now have a problem how to move these channels also to relate to the Russians living in the neighborhood in other countries. But these channels are not meant for instance, Estonia. When a Russian in Estonia looks at the first Russian channel, he or she doesn't relate to it in a way that the person in Russia who is in an information, closed information space relates to it. When I was in Russia as an ambassador during the Russian attack to Ukraine, then Russians didn't have any other tool, so they used Vremya, the Russian main news, every day, 1 hour from 9 o'clock in Russia, is the big newscast, Vremya. This was all about Ukraine. So when I looked at it, it was like a Ukrainian newscast, a fake Ukrainian newscast. They had to use it to exercise influence on Ukraine. They don't have good targeted, not that I'm sad about it, but they don't have good targeted policies towards the neighborhood when it comes to propaganda. Because the neighborhood Russians don't trust the simple party lines. They have internal propaganda, and then they have RT, which is meant for you guys, which is meant to deceive Western Europe, the United States. Now, you might say they are not necessarily very successful, but this is meant for the Western audience. And I think we have found good ways to push back RT, because I don't think we should consider them a proper news channel, but rather tool of the Russian government. And your question is about question about the arms control. Well, Russia violated the treaty. It deployed the weapon. It not only developed the weapon, but it deployed the missile. So if one side violates the treaty, it is, for me, essentially totally pointless. I know that there are arms control enthusiasts who believe that whatever happens in real life, the arms control treaty is something good in itself. But I'm not from that group. I'm not an arms control specialist. Well, so I believe that the treaty became moot. I think the enormously smart thing the United States did was to garner a consensus among NATO allies who supported, including all Western European countries, who supported the US decision to withdraw from that bilateral treaty. Because the treaty has a lot of relevance, of course, to countries like Germany and others. So that there was a unified understanding that one should withdraw, and there was a unified understanding why one should withdraw. I think this was of great great benefit. And if somebody says that, you know, NATO is brain dead, NATO's political side is brain dead, I always bring this INF debate as an example, that you can actually use NATO for political purposes if you work and diligently consult with allies and try to achieve consensus.
Fantastic. I think we have time for one more question, and I think we'll come here to the fourth row if we could, please.
Mr. Minister, thank you for a wonderful discussion. I'm Emilia. I'm from Ukraine myself. As you may know, on February 18th, there has been another massive provocation created by Russian militants in the Luhansk region of Ukraine. Our president has said it, like, this provocation was caused to disrupt this peacemaking process because Putin wants to establish peace in his own way. And as you can see, Ukraine has been following all the international treaties. We've been following the Normandy format to show our international partners that we are ready to create peace, we're ready to establish it, but without giving up the territory of Ukraine and our people. So I'm just wondering if you could give any particular advice to what maybe possible moves that Ukraine can take to prevent Russian aggression, or how to minimize any risks from Russia and... Thank you.
Yeah, there's probably no one good answer for it. I think Ukraine has done a lot, and in the end, I think sanctions helped and Western policy helped, but in the end, it was the Ukrainian army which stopped the movement of Russian forces. I think... people still remember the concept of New Russia, or Nova Russia, which Putin spoke about when I was there as an ambassador. It was almost an official concept because the president spoke about it all the time. Nova Russia was, as you know, the idea was that it would go up to Dnepr, essentially halving the Ukraine. So we are luckily very far from that, and the Ukrainian army did a very good job in fighting that. I am also very supportive of President Zelensky's approach to find a peaceful solution to the conflict, I really applaud his bravery. I know that it is not easy to do that. All kinds of finding peace is always very easy. Very, very difficult, not easy at all. But I think it's unrealistic to shoot for a solution whereby all these problems will be suddenly solved. I'm very skeptical of the fact that one day Putin arrives in his office and says, what the hell, let's go out of Ukraine, let's be friends, all of us. I think the idea that we should step by step exchange prisoners, enlarge the line of neutrality between the two opposing armored forces, etc., we start with the small steps, and perhaps at some point it will generate enough goodwill that we can manage to do something bigger. But you're absolutely right. These armed incursions, of course, immediately destroy not only the logic of peace talks, but the whole atmosphere of peace talks, and that's really sad. That's really sad.
Mr. Minister, I've learned a lot. I admire your wisdom and thoughtfulness in discussing these issues. Very best of wishes going forward, and thank you for all you've done for NATO and for your country.
Thank you.